Our planet formed more than 4,500 million years ago, at the same time as the other planets in the solar system. And at first, like them, it was a barren, lifeless place. There were no oceans, or lakes, or mountains. The surface was just covered with a sea of molten rock. And now, more than 4 billion years later, there's almost no remaining traces of those ancient times. But there are a few places around the world. The desert of Western Australia, or here in Greenland, where the rocks contain clues about why the Earth was made for life. Now, this is one of the oldest surviving pieces of the Earth's surface, but our story starts long before even these rocks were formed.
Well, it's believed that the Earth formed about 4.5 billion years ago. At this early time, the planets were growing, and they originally grew from a disk of dust and gas that was orbiting the sun. And as solid objects in this disk collided with one another, they grew into larger and larger gravitationally bound aggregates, and it's through this history of collisions that we think the Earth was formed.
Robin Knapp from the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado, uses powerful supercomputers to model the earliest moments of Earth's history. We know, for instance, that our planet emerged from a cloud of dust and gas, which had been drifting listlessly around the galaxy for perhaps billions of years, before it finally collapsed into a disk and started to coalesce. Most probably, the trigger was a shockwave from a supernova, a gigantic explosion that marks the death throes of a star.
It would be nice to be able to point to an existing star and say that was responsible for causing the collapse of the cloud and gas and dust that ultimately became our solar system. There certainly is evidence that a supernova went off near our solar system around the time it started to form. We see that in the presence of certain kinds of isotopes. But there is no particular star we can point to now and say, aha, that's the smoking gun, that's the culprit, that's what sent out the shock waves that caused our cloud of gas and dust to collapse down, eventually becoming the planetary system we live in, and allowing us, in fact, to evolve and sit here today asking questions about where we came from. In a very real sense, we are orphans. We don't know who our parent was.
Michael Drake from the University of Arizona in Tucson. We'll be hearing more from him later. We may not know much about our planet's genealogy, but the Earth today contains at least a few faint clues about its earliest history. Throughout this series, we'll be traveling round the world to the places that provide direct, though sometimes murky, windows into our distant past. Sadly, there's no way to visit an exploding star or even watch a cloud in space begin to congeal into a rocky, rigid planet. But to find out how and when our home planet was born, we can look at other pieces of rock that formed at the same time, in the same sort of way, and that have since conveniently fallen onto the Earth's surface. In other words, meteorites. Alex Halliday from the Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich.
There's a particular class of meteorite called chondrites, which aren't like the kind of rocks that you find on Earth at all. They appear to be accumulations of dust and debris that never made it into planets and never melted on a large scale. And these chondrites preserve for us some indications of the kind of stuff from which the planets eventually formed. And when we look at these chondrites, we find some very old grains thought to be the earliest objects that we can actually look at under the microscope that formed within our solar system. These were dated by scientists at the University of Paris at 4,566 million years, plus or minus 2 million years. And people always use this as the start of the solar system.
So now we know with amazing accuracy exactly when the Earth started to form. But what about how? The material in those meteorites is like the builder's rubble left over from the creation of our solar system. And it had a lucky escape. The stuff that went into planets went through a pulverizing process that Robin Knapp says would have been truly dramatic.
Early on, this disk contained a lot of gas and dust. It would have been like a very dense cloud to look through. there were small, what we call planetesimals, that were orbiting the sun, and they were careening into each other through collisions that occurred at very high speeds, on the order of 1 to 10 kilometers per second. And the energy associated with these collisions meant that the growing planets at this time were largely molten. We probably would have seen active volcanism on these growing planets, and the planets in their early growth stages may have had massive atmospheres. So between these giant collisions, you might have had a very dense water steam atmosphere around the growing planets, and immediately after the collision, the energies were high enough to actually vaporize silicate rock. And so you may have also had episodes of literally a rock vapor atmosphere enveloping this 2,000 to 3,000 degrees planetary surface.
If you can imagine, the Earth is actually made of tens to hundreds of various sized planetary embryos colliding with each other and gradually building things up. And eventually what you're doing is you have no more planetary embryos. What you have is planets colliding with each other. You have full-scale planetary collisions, and that ends up building an object the size of our Earth. So it could well be that the Earth at one stage was about the size of Mars, and then it collided with another Mars-sized object, and then that collided with something else. And you gradually built up the Earth over periods of tens of millions of years.
When you think about how much has happened to the Earth in the 4.5 billion years since it was born, it's amazing that we can deduce anything at all about its early life. There's no baby book, no videos, no clear record at all. Or perhaps it's more like the most frustrating of crime scenes.
Deciphering the early history of the Earth, or any other planet for that matter, is very much like a forensic detective story. The way I like to think of it is the crime occurred a long time ago and the evidence has been tampered with. 4.5 billion years has gone by on a very, very active planet. So it's like a policeman coming on a scene of a crime days after it occurred, trying to reconstruct the nature of the crime.
And the most dramatic crime that took place, the formation of the moon, was nothing short of murder.
To be honest, when it was first proposed, it was seen as somewhat of a harebrained idea, mostly because people were averse to the notion that some chance catastrophic event would have left us with our Earth and Moon. That seemed a little disconcerting.
That chance event was a catastrophic collision between the very young Earth and another sister planet, to which Alex Halliday has given a whimsical name.
We call it Theia because Theia is the goddess who was the mother of Selene, the goddess of the Moon. And so we figured that because basically Theia gave birth to Selene, we should basically say that Theia was a planet that gave birth to the Moon.
We're talking about something that was three times the size of the Moon, that contained 10% of the mass of the Earth. So this is an enormous impact. This makes any other impact that we know about later in Earth's history, things like the dinosaur killing impact, this one, you know, is many orders of magnitude larger than any of those. So this planet comes in and it hits the Earth at an off-center impact, and the collision is so massive that it actually partially rips the Earth apart. And what we believe happens is that after an initial hit, the Earth is essentially melted completely by the energy of the impact. The figure of the Earth itself is distorted. After this initial off-center hit, the impactor separates slightly from the Earth, coalescing somewhat into itself again before coming back in for a second collision with the Earth. And this second collision was the end of the impactor. At this point, the impacting object was completely destroyed. Most of its material rained down onto the Earth. And about 10% of the impactor's mass goes into this disk of vaporized rock and magma in the equatorial plane of the Earth. And this whole process that I've just described is believed to have taken about 20, 24 hours. And after about a day, we're left with an Earth that has reassumed a fairly regular spherical shape. It's very oblate along its equator because it's spinning very rapidly. This is when the day was only 5 hours long. And it's surrounded and actually enveloped by this cloud of vaporized rock and magma that's forming a disk around the Earth. In some ways, like a hot version of Saturn's rings. Only instead of just having particles in this disk, we also had a lot of vaporized rock gas. Then after that, we think things on a geologic time scale actually proceeded rather rapidly. This hot disk of material around the Earth probably took about a couple decades to cool. And once the material had cooled, the moon coalesced in a very short time of only maybe a few months to a year. And at that point, it was about 15 times closer to the Earth than it is today. And so you can imagine, if you were able to stand on that early Earth, it probably wouldn't have been a very nice place to be. But if you were able to stand there, you would look up in the sky, and to look at the newly formed moon would be to see something 15 times bigger than what's still an extraordinary full moon to see today. So it would have been quite a sight.
Think about that the next time you see a full moon. And Alex Halliday has figured out something interesting about the vanished planet Theia by looking at the elemental makeup of the moon she left behind.
One of the things we find is that this planet was remarkably similar to the Earth in terms of the material of which it was built. And we figure this out using oxygen isotopes. Oxygen has three isotopes, 16, 17, and 18. So they basically belong to the same element, but they have a slightly different mass. And most of the oxygen is oxygen-16, but these other isotopes, 17 and 18, which are slightly heavier, vary in their abundance. And in the earliest solar system, the whole disk was very varied in its isotopic composition. And objects, as they formed into planets, they took whatever oxygen was around them, and that oxygen acts as a kind of fingerprint of where it was formed. So if we look at various kinds of meteorites and compare them with the Earth, we find big differences. Now, what's striking is that the Moon has absolutely identical oxygen isotopic composition to the Earth, so much so that it's as if they were part of the same planet. So what we conclude from this is that this other planet was actually forming very close to the Earth.
In other words, Theia wasn't just a sister planet, it was our twin. And we killed it. And the violence didn't stop there. After that dramatic, appalling planet crash, the Earth was incandescent. Dante would have been proud.
We believe that the Earth was molten down to a depth of about 1,000 kilometers, a globally encircling ocean of liquid rock. The magma ocean would be a spectacular event to observe. If you could imagine standing off the Earth as it grew in a space with a spacecraft, one would see it glowing at a very high temperature, probably thousands of degrees centigrade, basically glowing red hot. You would be shielding yourself from the heat, much like you'd shield yourself from a campfire.
Some campfire sounds more like a furnace to me.
This magma ocean would last for thousands, perhaps up to a million years, and until that rock solidified about 4.45 billion years ago, there's no chance for life to get started on Earth. So in a very real sense, that magma ocean event was time zero for all subsequent geological and biological history on the planet.
So when it comes to life, that one moment 4.45 billion years ago was time zero. But even though certain events in the build-up were unbelievably hostile and violent, they were also crucial for the life that would come afterwards. One good reason that life can survive happily on Earth is that we're a very comfortable distance from the sun. Not too hot, not too cold, our Goldilocks planet is just right. But there's more to it than a pleasant position in space. It now seems that the geology of the Earth also made our planet ripe for life. First, the presence of the moon.
The moon, in essence, you could say, acts as a gravitational counterbalance to the Earth, and it acts to stabilize the tilt of Earth's rotational axis. So in other words, the tilt of our North Pole. So currently that tilt is about 23.5 degrees. That gives us our general seasonal weather pattern. And with the moon, that tilt is very stable. It only changes by about a degree or so on a long time scale. If we hadn't experienced the moon forming impact and we didn't have the moon, then the tilt of Earth's rotational axis would vary chaotically between values as low as 0 degrees and as high as 80 degrees. So in other words, from having the North Pole completely pointing upright to having the whole Earth literally turned on its side. So, for example, a single hemisphere like the Northern Hemisphere would be facing the Sun for much of the Earth's orbit around the Sun. So this is actually similar to what we think happens to Mars today. Mars lacks a massive satellite like the Moon, and from our calculations, the tilt of Mars's North Pole does vary with such wide extremes and chaotically over its history. And this may have played a role in the lack of a stable climate on that planet.
And even that hellish sea of molten rock created by the formation of the Moon helped set the stage for life. Bizarre though it sounds, that's ultimately where the world's water came from.
An ocean of magma is like a sponge. You can soak up an enormous amount of water into liquid rock. But as it solidifies, that water has to go somewhere. The minerals that would be formed will not take up very much water. And most of that water presumably came out to the surface of the planet to make the oceans, and perhaps early on even a steam atmosphere if it was much hotter than it is today. So it's likely that liquid water formed on the planet very early in Earth's history as the magma ocean cooled down.
And though that initial heat sounds like bad news for life, it's also the driving force for processes that are still important on Earth today. The most overriding geological principle we have is that the continents are restless. Instead of remaining fixed in one place, they drift around the planet's surface, sometimes crashing together to form new mountain ranges, sometimes tearing apart to create oceans. And all of this started because of those early searing conditions.
One of the things you have to do to have a planet that looks like our planet today is fairly quickly get rid of the heat in that magma ocean. There's an enormous amount of heat soaked up in liquid rock. Now, the planet radiates, and that's a very effective way of losing heat to space, but that only radiates from the surface, so you have to find a way of transporting the heat from the interior to the surface. And the best way to do that is by convection. Now, convection is no more complicated than what happens when you heat up a pot of soup on the stove. It gets hot at the bottom, and the lighter material that's hot rises to the surface. So the Earth probably, during its magma ocean phase, convected very, very vigorously and perhaps gave us the earliest style of plate tectonics, the mechanism by which the planet now loses its heat.
And as the magma ocean cooled, its chemistry changed radically. That's why we have continents at all.
Today we know we need continents for terrestrial life, obviously, and we probably needed shallow seas for the earliest life to get started. So that process of losing heat from the magma ocean 4.5 billion years ago led to plate tectonics, which led inexorably to the formation of continents, which have continued to grow to the present day. So normally we think about habitable planets having liquid water, organic material, and energy. Part of what makes our own planet habitable is this process of plate tectonics that leads to shallow seas and land emerging above the seas. So, in a sense, plate tectonics is something special about our planet and has probably had a profound influence on the development of life on this planet.
So now at last, we're getting close to the most tangible part of the Earth's beginnings, the part that we can see and touch. Just a few tens of millions of years after the magma ocean cooled, certain tiny minerals formed, ones that are such tenacious survivors that we can find them intact today.
Okay. This is where you've got to watch out for snakes.
Yeah, could be some snakes. Like this weather, it's warming.
The Jack Hills are set among rugged sheep stations in the West Australian outback. The scene is anything but pastoral. In fact, it's more like a desert. There's so little grazing there, apart from a few sparse clumps of dried grass and tough, scrubby bushes, that the stock is forced to scatter, and you rarely see more than a few scraggly sheep together. In fact, it's easier to spot their competition, the kangaroos and wallabies bouncing along on their dusty red trails. To reach the hills, you have to negotiate bush tracks in a four-wheel drive, lurching over boulders and trying not to rip your tires on the jagged thorns. And then there's the hot slog up the slopes. Fortunately, my guide, Simon Wild, knew his stuff. He's been visiting the area for 2 decades.
1983,
this is...
That's the first time
you came. First time we came here, it was 1983.
The reason I'm interested in the Jack Hills is they provide the first concrete record of Earth history. Though, like many points of historic significance, this would be easy to miss.
So this is it. When it first came here, this outcrop is about 2 metres above what we see at the moment. So you can see these various collectors have been in, including ourselves, and removed a lot more material. But this is all it is. It's the size of a four-wheel drive.
Just this outcrop right mm-hmm. here?
Yep.
It's not very big.
Not at all.
The Jack Hills probably started forming around 3 billion years ago. That sounds pretty old. It's some 2.5 billion years before the first fish swam in the sea. But it's still way past the era I'm interested in. The hills aren't even that impressive to look at. Just an ordinary ridge, a few hundred feet high, sticking out of the surrounding plains. What is impressive, though, is that the material they contain is extraordinarily old, much older than the hills themselves. Inside Simon Wild's jumbled mix of rocks, his conglomerate, there are tiny, resilient minerals called zircons that have somehow survived since the earliest moments of Earth's history.
Conglomerates are very good for sampling, if you think about it, because they've got fragments of different rocks. They've got other ones which are crushed up to give you the matrix to these pebbles. So they're good collectors of heavy minerals. And so what we did was said, well, okay, if we've got old stuff in this belt, it's most likely to be in a rock like this, which has undergone less sorting than, let's say, a pure sand, which has clearly just filtered out everything except for the quartz, which makes up the sand.
So you take advantage. This stuff was made from sort of rivers transporting all sorts of junk and squashing it together, and eventually it becoming
Yeah, we believe the environment for this particular rock was in what we refer to as a fan delta. Best way of thinking of that is if you went to a modern active mountain range and drove along a valley, and you'd see small side valleys shedding material in a big fan at the base. This is the sort of thing that we thought this rock might have formed in.
So, okay, if these are sediments, that means that they're made up of older rocks. So what were they made up of?
So what we've got is really two or three sorts of pebbles making up the conglomerate. We can see we've got lots of quartz, uh-huh. which formed in veins, so uh-huh. this is what we call vein quartz.
This pebble here?
Yep. There are other ones which have some layering in them, which we refer to as chert. They're also made up of silica, but they're much finer grained, uh-huh. and they were chemical precipitates on the seafloor. And the third type of rock we find very rarely are banded iron formation pebbles.
Uh-huh. So this rock is just a complete mix of all these
it's
previous
a complete mix,
bits and pebbles?
But it's a mix of only the survivors.
But within those pebbles and within the rock, there's much older, very resistant minerals, isn't
Indeed. There? There are the zircon crystals that we've been dating. And the zircon crystals are scattered not only, we've found them in the pebbles, some of the quartzy pebbles, but we've also found them in the matrix. They're predominantly in the matrix. And these crystals show a range of ages in this particular rock from 3 billion years way back to 4.4 billion.
4.4 billion. So those are the ones. Those are the key. Those are the oldest minerals.
Those are the oldest crystals known on Earth at the present time, yes.
And could there be some of them right here in this rock now?
There could well be, because this is the site which seems to have more 4-billion-year-old crystals than any other that we've looked at which is adjacent to this site.
So, I mean, can I see them?
Afraid not. They're so small. We're looking at really the head of a pin.
But you see them down a microscope.
You can see them down a microscope. You see them when they're concentrated, which is what we do to get them all together and have a pure sample. But you'd be very hard pushed to actually find them in here. So even if I break this rock off and then look at this with a hand lens, which is the standard geological technique, 10 times hand lens, I look around in here. There's nothing that I can see instantaneously. There's a zircon.
Down a microscope, Simon Wild's zircons are gorgeous, multifaceted shards, deep purple with a faint hint of brown. Shaken together in a glass tube, they look like grains of sand, but they're much rarer than that. It took 40 kilograms of crushed slabs of rock to produce just a few thimblefuls of these precious grains. And they're precious because they come almost directly from time zero. First, they formed as crystals inside one of the very earliest rocks, and then they resisted every attempt to destroy them. As the parent rocks were ground up and eroded, the zircons were simply washed away. Perhaps they were carried deep inside the earth, They may have been heated, cooled, erupted from the heart of a volcano back out onto the surface, yet all the while they remained intact. And now, for some reason, these particular zircons have ended up inside a few nondescript pebbles in a nondescript outcrop.
The only reason we ever collected this in the first place was it's prominent, it was easy to get at, and you could hit it with a big hammer. We could lean on it, bash it, and we took it.
So it's just it was luck? It's just luck?
It's basically luck, because we could have gone on that hill and hit a sample from over there. We have, of course, since then, gone to many of these adjacent rocks that you can see, and we've collected samples from there. We found crystals over 4 billion years old. We found some younger ones, but we haven't found anything that matches what is really concentrated in this particular layer of conglomerate.
So what you really want to do, though, is you want to find the rocks that those tiny minerals...
Exactly. We'd like to find the rocks that mineral formed in. We're working backwards from a small crystal to say what the rock would have been like. We have evidence now that it was a granitic rock. It was like an ordinary piece of granite. And we believe that that's exactly the sort of rock that was the parent.
But not so ordinary. If it's
well, obviously
so
not
old.
So ordinary. And it's clearly the oldest by a long way. The oldest rocks that we have and we can handle from Northwest Territories in Canada and to Castor, and they are just 4.03, still pretty old, but a long way to go if you want to get 4.404 billion years.
So that's the next test, try and find it.
To try, we've looked, of course, because, as I mentioned before, what we have is these clasts, which are...
These pebbles,
which are pre-existing rocks, essentially, but they're mainly quartz, because quartz is the most resistant thing. So these things will survive several weathering cycles, they'll survive being left on the Australian desert, they'll be the real survivors. But we would like to find within here a piece of granite, and we've looked very extensively over several kilometres of length here, just looking for that one or two bits of material that may still be there.
So if you found...
If we found a granite clast, we'd be jumping up in the air and saying Eureka, because there'd be every chance that would be a 4 billion year old rock.
Sadly, that could remain just a dream for Simon Wild. Next week, though, I will get to walk over the oldest remaining surface on Earth. But be prepared. Just because the surface is there doesn't make the rock detective's job any easier.
And these rocks have been through the mill. It's amazing that you can see anything original in them. They've been metamorphosed, they've been folded and fissured and faulted and fractured and...
everything else starting with F
until the all original life has been squeezed out of them.
An Earth Made for Life was presented by Gabriel Walker and produced by Roland Pease. And you can listen to it again on the Radio 4 website.